This hour, we'll find out how the pioneers shaped our Thanksgiving traditions, learn about a unique regiment that fought in the Spanish-American War, and discover what makes Dallas County significant in American history. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, a preview of History Camp Iowa 2017. It takes place on Saturday, November 11th at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. A mix of professional and amateur historians share their expertise with history buffs from all over the state. I'll talk with organizer Danny Ackright and five of this year's presenters about the topics they'll be sharing with history campers. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a preview of History Camp Iowa 2017. This is the third annual History Camp Iowa. It takes place on Saturday, November 11th at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. A mix of professional and amateur historians will share their expertise with history buffs from all over the state. And we are going to cover a lot of history this hour. But first, I'll talk with one of the organizers of History Camp. Danny Ackright is community manager of the Food Bank of Iowa, clearly also a history buff. Hello, Danny.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Now, this is the third year of History Camp Iowa. This is an idea that started out in Cambridge, Massachusetts a few years ago. What do you think makes History Camp such a special experience for people?
Well, History Camp is an unconference, which basically means that it's a conference with any barriers removed. So really, anybody can attend, anybody can present. So, you know, we don't have any professional associations that you have to be a member of or anything like that. You don't have to have a PhD to talk about whatever topic you're passionate about. So it really brings together professionals, archivists, museum professionals, and people just with a passion for history, just like me, to share their favorite stories.
What are you most excited about this year?
Oh, I just, you know, every year this is my favorite time of year approaching History Camp. We've got such an interesting slate of presentations. We've got Iowa's Native American history. We've got Governor Ray and refugees. We've got a steamboat captain. I really get excited about the diversity of presentations and the people who come with such a personal passion to talk about what interests them.
How do you find the presenters?
Well, we take advantage of kind of the networks that we've been able to build over the last couple of years. We have people who've presented for a couple of years. We've got people who just hear about us or attend and decide that they want to join in and share their stories in the next year. And then with the help of my fellow organizers, Leo Landis, Hope Bibbins, and Megan Ben-Dixon, we reach out to the people we know who are nerds like us and want to come and share their passions as well.
And there's still time to register if people want to go, right?
Absolutely. If people want to register, all they need to do is go to historycamp.org/Iowa, and they can get set up for our main event this Saturday.
All right. And we are going to continue with our preview. Danny, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Danny Ackright, one of the organizers of History Camp Iowa. And with me now is one of the presenters. Michael Vogt is the curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. And he's chosen this year to share a unique story from Iowa history about Company M, 7th Regiment, an African-American regiment that fought in the Spanish-American War. Hello, Michael.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thank you for being here. And let's go back to 1898. There was a nationwide call for volunteers to fight in the Spanish-American War, but it wasn't just a general call for volunteers. What was the military looking for?
Correct. The military were looking for, like present-day, able-bodied individuals, but the McKinley administration also realized at that time the political necessity of allowing as many people to serve as possible. So they put out a couple of volunteers initially for 125,000 men, later on 75,000 men. And also they wanted to organize 10 U.S. volunteer regiments. All of these regiments were supposed to be immunes, meaning that they wanted people, and I don't know how they tested this at that time, basically presumption, individuals that they thought would provide immunity to tropical diseases, malaria, typhoid fever, yellow fever, etc. And four of those regiments were to be made up of African Americans. So they recruited four regiments of black volunteers, and presuming, you know, based on racial presumption, that they would be magically immune to tropical diseases. And that, of course, was not the case.
Right. And so putting out this call, were they specifically asking for African-American volunteers? Did they make that explicit, or was that word immune? Was that code?
The legislation indicated that the numbered 1 through 10 regiments 7, 8, 9, and 10 were to be comprised of African-American volunteers.
So in Iowa, this company formed, Company M, 7th Regiment. Was that made up of African-American men who were Iowans?
Yes, correct. Most of the personnel, originally 76, leave Des Moines, and they would recruit it up to 84 by the end of the war. Most of them were from Des Moines, Iowa, and several of them probably lived along the Center Street district that we'll hear more about in a little bit.
Right.
And so they were all Des Moines. There were, I think, four or five from Missouri that I presume joined the unit after they went down to Jefferson Barracks. But 99% of the inductees are from Des Moines, from the local area.
And this was a volunteer company, and the way the military had done things in the past, a volunteer company would normally elect its officers. But in this case, presumably because it was an African-American company, the military did not do that.
Correct. There were African-American units that were serving, and typically they served in the regular Army, the 24th, 25th Regiment of Regiments of Infantry, and the 9th and 10th Cavalry Regiments, the Buffalo Soldiers that fought with distinction in the Indian Wars, had typically white officers, a captain, a first, and a second lieutenant. When they create this unit, there are some political concerns over appointing a black captain to Company M. Individuals offered their names. There was some negotiation back and forth. And finally, they settled on a black real estate agent that came well recommended, a Captain Amos Brandt, was appointed by the War Department as the company captain. And then the remainder of the company was able to elect their officers, which were black officers, a first lieutenant, Edward McAfee, and a second lieutenant, Robert Wilbur.
Tell me a little bit about their service once the regiment was formed.
They go down to Jefferson Barracks, receive uniforms, receive equipment, undergo basic training. Later on, they move down to Lexington. And basically, it's garrison duties. They undertake company drill, brigade drill, regimental drill, spend time at the small arms range, learn how to handle weapons. And later they end up serving down in Macon, Georgia. They camp in a cotton field about 3 miles outside of Macon. And it's down there that these Iowans from Des Moines come in contact with some of the more overt aspects of the Jim Crow South.
How do we know about that? What kind of records were left behind?
Some left letters. There were newspaper articles that were published at the time. In a number of the troops that were brigaded with the Iowans, especially the Iowa Company, were not used to this type of activity, and so they really didn't stand for it. They learned in a hurry that if you're going to go downtown, if you're going to patronize a restaurant or walk the streets, it's best to bring your weapon with you, that tended to speak more than arguments in terms of racial slurs and insults that were thrown at these soldiers.
Did they see combat?
They did not. The war ends early. The Spanish-American War only runs about 4 months. Ceasefire is negotiated in August of 1898. And as a result, even though they were slated to travel to Cuba for occupation duty, the quick end of the war brought those orders to a halt. They were countermanded, and the unit was discharged on the 28th of February, 1899, and they arrived back in Des Moines on 3 March of 99 and attended a reception at the state capitol to welcome them home.
What caught your attention about this story? Why did you decide to dig into it?
Well, 20 years ago, I was working on a master's thesis in history at the University of Northern Iowa, and that topic was Iowa and the Spanish-American War, so this unit's history ended up coming under my gaze as a result of that research 20 years ago and earlier. I pulled together some information and published the story in the Des Moines Register in February 2003 as a Black History Month article, and expanded it from there. And I've given it as a presentation here or there over the years.
And why do you think it's an important story to tell?
It's an interesting point in the evolution of black civil rights and the role of blacks in the military. It isn't until shortly after World War II, I think 1948, that President Truman desegregates the military. But it's by small gains. The fact that two of these officers were elected locally is something that was a bit unusual, especially for Iowa. It wouldn't be until World War I that the Army would launch its first African-American officer candidate school at Fort Des Moines and allow blacks to enter the Army as officers in larger numbers. So it's a step down that path of social equality. And that would later, you know, these experiences and the way that these troops successfully acquitted themselves during the war helps them along that path.
Interesting. Well, and this is a story that I would guess was nearly forgotten. There aren't a lot of artifacts left. You mentioned a few letters, but because the Spanish-American War is not one that we've focused on, in studying history, this was one that could have easily been overlooked forever.
Correct. Artifacts are rare. I'm aware of only two photos. One was published in the Bystander about 1910 or 12. They did an anniversary or retrospective issue, and that's the only unit photo that I'm aware of. In private hands, there exists a photo of a soldier that served in Company M, and the flag from that unit exists in the collection of the State Historical Society. And there's one document that we have in our own collection at the museum at Camp Dodge, which is a church service program. A guy came in one day and he said, I picked this up at a garage sale. I'm not sure if you're interested in it. My eyes grew wide because I saw right on it Company M, 7th Volunteers, and I knew exactly what unit that belonged to.
So what do you think we can learn from this story today?
It's a story where in today's society, some of the things that the presumptions that were made about these people at that time are reprehensible then, but much more widely accepted at that time. So it's a good checkpoint along the way to see to determine how racial relations have evolved, how equality has made its way through the military, and how through some of these examples, like here and later at Fort Des Moines in World War I, we learned that if you give people a chance, oftentimes they will not only meet but exceed your expectations.
Well, Michael Vogt, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Michael Vogt is the curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. He is one of the presenters at History Camp 2017, which is coming up on Saturday. There is still time to register for the event. You can find out all about it at historycamp.org/Iowa. You can also register there. And this hour, we are doing a preview of many of the presentations that are going to take place at History Camp, which is a unique mix of professional and amateur historians sharing topics that they feel passionate about. We'll find out a lot more in just a few minutes on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of History Camp 2017, taking place Saturday, November 11th at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. History buffs, some amateur, some professional, will be sharing their expertise on many different subjects. Sarah Utoff's presentation is Wilder Thanksgiving, From Pioneer to Pilgrim. She is a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College and an expert on the life and times of Laura Ingalls Wilder. She's also a Laura Ingalls Wilder impersonator, giving speeches and performances all over the Midwest, and she's host of the Trundlebed Tales podcast. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here. So when we think about Thanksgiving, of course, most of us think about the pilgrims and those tales of the first Thanksgiving. But you think that our ideas of a traditional Thanksgiving are more shaped by the Victorians and by the pioneers. Why do you think that?
Well, this was actually a program that I put together for the National Living History Conference with Kathleen Wall, who is the spokesmodel for Thanksgiving at Plymouth Plantation. So she covered the Pilgrim part and I covered the 19th century part, because it turns out that Thanksgiving is a bit more of an invented holiday than we like to admit. People think that it kind of started out with what she calls the 1621 event and came down unchanged from that, but it really didn't. In fact, it wasn't until about the 1840s that people decided that that was a big important first event after Thanksgiving had kind of gotten started in the early 1800s. It used to be in Pilgrim's times, a Thanksgiving day meant a day of fasting. So our big Thanksgiving dinner is more like their harvest celebration. And if they saw a big dinner and we told them that was Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims would be like, yeah, I don't think so.
So much more a day of feasting than of fasting. So when did we start seeing it celebrated pretty regularly?
It slowly turned over to being a meal more about, a day more about family and a meal. In the early 1820s, 1830s, it didn't really get standardized all through the different years coming up to about the Civil War. People had them on different days. They might be in a different day in November. They may be in October, like our friends the Canadians. It was just whatever state wanted to proclaim a day, that would be it. And especially the southern states didn't enjoy having the same dates as the northern states, especially after Abraham Lincoln declared the first, you know, sort of national Thanksgiving meal kind of day. It's just really...
So that's a deeper part of our tradition than we might imagine.
It is.
Take us to Laura Ingalls Wilder's time and her family. And, you know, I realize that you have studied her life well beyond her childhood. Mm-hmm. So maybe describe a typical, if there was such a thing, a typical Thanksgiving during that period.
There is my favorite Thanksgiving story, and Laura published it as a Thanksgiving story first in The Ruralist. It was when they were having an argument about sage or onion. Mary wanted the sage and Laura wanted the onion, and they got in a huge fight about it for this goose. Either I think it was a goose they were going for that Pa was going out to shoot. This is one of the few times I side with Mary over Laura. Sage all the way. But when Pa came back, he hadn't gotten the goose because they had been flying over so fast. And so Laura says that her lesson from that is that you ought to be glad of your blessings, even if they aren't quite flavored the way you'd like. So there were some things that we probably wouldn't expect to see, like mashed turnips would be just as common as mashed potatoes, because turnips were kind of equal to potatoes for a long time throughout the 19th century. And
right. So when the when Thanksgiving started to be more of a thing, when, you know, people started celebrating it more regularly, was that kind of an invention of those times that they wanted this sort of new tradition to seem much more ancient and historical?
Yeah, it really was. It was partly a part of the colonial revival that was going on. It, you know, whenever we get close to 1876, and by close I mean a couple decades, and we get really kind of history crazy, and we usually have another colonial revival. So people wanted to tie this back to that. There was also a real push, a deliberate push to try and make America coming from, you know, Plymouth Rock and that sort of thing, even though Jamestown, that was Southern gold digging, and I mean, literally, they were looking for gold, wanted to come from the pious, religious Northern Plymouth tradition rather than that. So anything they could put on that was in American culture that came from Plymouth, they were all for. But it was a pretty deliberate thing. But there was a lot of colonial stuff in the culture anyway. There was actually a woman named Jane Austen, she kind of, she was married to an Austin, but she dropped the Mary from her name, and it's Austin with an I instead of an E. Uh-huh. She wrote a whole series of books about the early pilgrims and claimed they were based on diaries, which she never produced. One was called Standish of Standish, and that was one that had a lot of focus on the Thanksgiving story and a lot of what we think of as that first pilgrim story comes from that book.
Interesting. So it was an invented history. So when you sit down to Thanksgiving this year and engage in our modern Thanksgiving tradition, what will you think about when you think about the history of why you're sitting down to the meal? What will make it special for you?
We're a lot more of family history, which is what it really is supposed to be. Well, has sort of become about is the history of the family. So we're going to have my mom's china out, good Victorian tradition. You get the nice dishes out. We're going to have my grandmother's stuffing recipe and my great-great-grandmother's hickory nut roll recipe, which is my all-time favorite, and my great-grandmother's steamed pudding, probably turducken, which my cousin just loves. And it's
a very recent tradition.
A very recent tradition. And green bean casserole. I mean, company product or not, it's just good.
Part of the tradition. And what do you hope people who come to your session at History Camp will take away from it?
First of all, you kind of have to question whether history is invented or not. I mean, not that it's a bad story, but it's good to know that it is a story. And also maybe to think a little bit about the role that the Victorians really had in shaping a lot more of our culture than I think people realize. They kind of created Thanksgiving. They kind of created Christmas the way we celebrate it. They created the idea of the dining room and all being a sort of a focal point of the house. The Victorians were a busy bunch.
We're still influenced today. Well, Sarah Utoff, thank you so much.
Well, I'm always glad to get a chance to come and see you, Charity.
Sarah Utoff is a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College, and she will be giving a presentation at History Camp, Wilder Thanksgiving, From Pioneer to Pilgrim. Next up, Darcy Malsby. She is an independent marketing specialist and author of Dallas County, also a culinary history of Iowa, but her presentation focuses on Dallas County. It's called A President to a Posse, How Truman, Bonnie and Clyde, and Dallas County, Iowa Changed American History. Hello, Darcy.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for coming back to the show. And you make a claim that no Iowa county has influenced American history more than Dallas County. Why is that?
Well, it's a bold claim, and I say no one's challenged me yet, but I figure when one county can single-handedly start the ball rolling to propel a president back into office, it doesn't get much bigger than that.
Okay, well, explain that for us. Dallas County propelled Harry Truman into office. How?
It did, and it started out on the farm of all places. So we have to go back in time to 1948. We are in an area just north of Dexter. And this is September of 48, and they are hosting the National Plowing Matches and Conservation Field Days out in some farmland north of town. And the organizers had actually invited Thomas Dewey, who was Truman's opponent, Republican opponent. They had invited him to come out and speak at this event, and he declined the offer. And Truman took them up on the offer. Maybe it was because of his Missouri farm boy ties, but he came out to Iowa with his whistle stop campaign, and that's what set the ball in motion.
Why do you feel that set the ball in motion? Like, what came out of that appearance?
Well, it happened in a 29-minute speech, so it wasn't all that long that he talked, but he was speaking to a crowd of 100,000 people. You know, back in those days, farming was a focus for so many Iowans and so many Midwesterners, and so it didn't get a lot bigger than the conservation field days and plowing matches. So it was a wonderful venue to be able to reach a huge number of people. And then there were a couple of things during that 29-minute speech that just electrified the crowd. Mainly how Truman went after the 80th Congress, and he called them the Do-Nothing Congress. And boy, did that stick. And it also gave him the moniker, Give 'em Hell, Harry. And remember, all this is happening just 6 weeks before the November 1948 elections, but the timing was perfect, and it just really propelled him back to the White House.
Well, and 100,000 people in a crowd in 1948, that seems pretty extraordinary. I mean, in a rural area in 1948, that's pretty extraordinary in and of itself.
It is, and my book has a lot of those old black and white pictures, and you look at the shot where the photographer was up on a platform behind Truman, and you're looking out at the crowd, and it's just this sea of people everywhere. And I just think it's fascinating, too. Sometimes we think of conservation in agriculture as kind of a new concept, but here they were back in the day. They were out in the fields when Truman wasn't speaking. One of the things he wanted to do was to go out into the demo fields and watch the crews build ponds and terraces, things to save soil and protect water quality. And last year I had the opportunity to visit a wonderful gentleman named Bob Larson, who lived in Perry. At the time, in 48, he was a young man, 19 years old, from Guthrie County. He was one of the bulldozer operators. And Truman, being that good Missouri farm boy, he wanted to go out and see the equipment work. And the Secret Service had told those guys, now shut off your machines because we don't want to disturb the president. Well, the president goes out there and throws off his suit jacket and strides across the field and comes upon Bob Larson. And he said, what the hell are you doing? Fire those machines up. So he jumps up on the bulldozer with Bob and rides around for 10 minutes. something that wouldn't happen today, probably.
Absolutely. So another piece of Dallas County history. And I think this is a story that a lot of people have heard, but it's one that is so often told because, again, an unlikely place with unlikely actors. This took place just 15 years before Harry Truman came to Dallas County. There was a shootout, a notorious shootout. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, so this is Iowa's biggest brush with Bonnie and Clyde. So to set the stage, you're exactly right. 15 years earlier is where this all went down. And ironically, it was right in the same general vicinity north of Dexter of where Truman gave his speech. And so Bonnie and Clyde and their gang had been involved in a big shootout down in Platte City, Missouri. And they were on the lam trying to find a place of refuge where they could kind of heal from some fairly serious wounds. And they came up here to Dallas County because there was an old Dexfield Park amusement park that had been big back in the teens and 20s, but the Depression kind of put the kibosh on all that. So they're up in a campground just trying to lay low and recover from some of these wounds. Well, it's hard when you've got bloody bandages and other things that where people in the area start figuring out, there's something not quite right going on there. Word gets around, hey, I think Bonnie and Clyde and the gang might be up there at Dexfield Park. And then all of a sudden, we've got a posse forming.
And then what happened?
Well, on the morning of July 24th, 1933, about 5:36 in the morning, all hell breaks loose, and you've got the posse, which in our minds, you would think a posse would be probably Dallas County Sheriff, state troopers, local law enforcement. But in those days, it could be anybody and everybody. It was law enforcement, but there was also a dentist from Des Moines that brought his own submachine gun.
Oh, my goodness.
So once all the shooting starts, Bonnie and Clyde actually were able to get across the river, and they went over to the Feller farm. So Marvell Feller was about 19 years old at the time. He was out helping his dad and hired man do some of the morning chores. And Bonnie was injured fairly bad, and so Clyde tells Marvell, we need your car, and he points a gun to emphasize we really need your car. And ironically, the Fellers had a Plymouth, which was a little bit different shifting than the Ford V8s that Clyde usually preferred. So Marvell got to give Clyde a quick driving lesson. And ironically, Clyde told Marvell, you will be well repaid for this. So Bonnie and Clyde escape along with W.D. Jones, a fellow gang member. Now, Clyde's older brother, Buck, not so lucky. He was severely injured in the shootout and was taken into custody. His wife, Blanche, also was taken into custody. And Buck was transported to King's Daughters Hospital up in Perry, and he ended up dying there 3 days later.
And was Marvell rewarded?
You know, it's funny you ask.
Was that a secret?
No. For years and years, of course, there was no reward from the gang because Bonnie and Clyde were killed in a shootout about 11 months later down in Louisiana. But here in the last few years, one of the relatives of the Barrow family came up to Dexter, visited the museum in town. It's a wonderful little museum. And he said, I want to make it right between the Barrows and the Fellers. And so he did donate some money. So I guess all is well now, even after all these years, they did make it right.
All right. So we don't have time to talk about a lot of the other events that took place in Dallas County, which apparently was a hoppin' county. Still is, right?
Still is, for sure.
Yeah, let's just mention a few of the really notable people who have come from Dallas County. Several Major League Baseball players.
Right. So I bet a lot of your audience has heard of Bob Feller, world famous Cleveland Indians pitcher in the Hall of Fame. Also, he had a cousin that also played Major League ball, maybe not quite as well known, but Hal Manders. Hal played for the Detroit Tigers and Chicago Cubs and then came back to Dallas County and farmed. And then if you want to talk football, of course, there's probably no bigger name than Niall Kinnick, a hometown Adel, Iowa boy.
And also a few politicians, right?
Yes. David Young hails from Dallas County. And so it's just really remarkable when you start adding up all the fascinating history that happened here, the big names that have been connected with Dallas County. It's an amazing place.
So interesting. And why do you think this is an important story to tell?
What I hope this does is it inspires people to take a new look at the history in their own local area. That I've found with kids especially, if you want to get them hooked on history, you start talking about the local history and they look at you and scratch their head and they're so intrigued and they can't get over the fact this happened here? Yes, it did. And one other thing that research has shown that I find so interesting, there have been university scientists that studied why some kids after 9/11 did better in the wake of those attacks than other kids. Some kids rebounded fast from the stress of all that, and others just fell apart. And the research shows that the kids who had a sense of their local history, their own family history, they understood that even in the midst of tragedy, you're part of a bigger continuum. Life doesn't end. You're part of the spectrum. And I figure if knowing history can give you that kind of confidence. Well, what a wonderful gift.
Darcy Malsby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a preview of History Camp Iowa 2017, the third annual History Camp Iowa. It's coming up on Saturday at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. You can find out more at historycamp.org/Iowa. And my next guest has chosen to focus on personal history for her presentation. Patricia Rose Ballard Coffey is the former director of the Waverly Public Library. Her presentation is Angels and Butterflies, Stories of My Mother and Father, Lifelong Iowans. Patricia, hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
And why did you decide to tell the story of your family at History Camp?
Well, they've been here a long, long time. Mom's family was among the first 400 settlers in what became Des Moines. And Dad's family was in a little town called Fairview before 1855. That little town is now Story City.
Oh, wow. And your mother's family was there by 1840, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So you have family ties going back a very long time in Iowa. And your parents, your grandparents aren't people whose names have made it into the history books. They're not famous for anything. But why do you think it's important to share the stories of normal, everyday Iowans?
Well, I really struggled with the concept of history as event date, event date, event date. And so I began to look for the answer to the question we all have, is there a place for me? Do I belong? Where am I in all of this? And it seemed to me family stories answered that and fed that fascination. Do I belong? Is there a place for me?
Now, you're going to tell a number of different stories about your family, and I know we don't have time to hear them all, but give us a little bit of a preview. You start with the story of your birth, right?
Right. I was born at home, and my mom was there, of course, but my dad was there, and my mom's cousin was there, and two doctors were there, and my grandma was there, and I was welcomed into love and life and family. And I think it's a powerful story, especially when we get to the place where my mother felt she actually met my guardian angel in person. She said, I'm not going to have to worry about you so much anymore.
Tell me what she saw or what happened to her that made her think that she had met your guardian angel.
Well, I seem to have had the croup and the measles at the same time when I was about 10 months old. And she'd been up for a week with my big sister and I by then. I'd finally gotten to the place where I could sleep without coughing and choking, so she laid down to sleep. And she said, then in the night, I woke up, I sat up, I got up, and I went into the room where you were in your crib. And on the other side of your crib, in the dark, I saw a being. And it was so real, I reached out to touch the being, but instead reached down, picked you up, stuck my fingers down your throat, got the phlegm cleared out, put you up on my shoulder, patted your back till you were breathing well again, and then I looked for that being, and it was gone. And that's how I knew I had met your guardian angel.
Another one of the stories that you're going to share is about how your dad taught you how to make gravy. Tell me what happened.
I was 15, and Dad had moved the seven of us, I have six brothers and sisters, out onto 40 acres near Altoona. He thought we'd grow up to be better people if we did some just plain hard work the way he did when he was growing up. So, I was 15. We moved into that house. The city house had a kitchen that would allow the table with the nine of us seated around it. And if you needed something else from the stove or the counter or the cupboard, you had to get up and walk over there. Same thing for the refrigerator. Now that same table was in the country house. And if you wanted something else, you just reached over and got it. And if you wanted something from the refrigerator, two people had to get up and move so you could open the door. It was a difficult move. And in the city, we had city water. But in the country, we had water pumped into the house from a cistern from a contaminated shallow well. So you could flush the toilet, and we did appreciate that. But you could not drink the water. So we hauled drinking water from Des Moines for nine people. Mom usually went, and she went to her mom and dad's because they were sympathetic. Now, it was Sunday. Mom went in to get water. I cut up and fried the three chickens that she had butchered the day before. I had, you know, an inch of Crisco in those cast iron skillets. I fixed mashed potatoes, I had sliced tomatoes, I had green beans. I had dinner all ready. Dad and two of my brothers were baling hay. And I knew my dad could tell time by where the sun was, and Mom wasn't back yet, and I didn't know how to make the gravy. So I went out to the field and waved my dad down. He pulled up with that John Deere B, and he choked it back enough that he could lean down and say, what do you need? I said, Daddy, I got the three chickens fried. I got the mashed potatoes. I got the sliced tomatoes. I got the green beans. Daddy, I have everything ready. Except Mom went into town to get water, and I don't know how to make the gravy. He leaned down and said, I don't care if you know how to make gravy or not. We are going to finish this pass on the field and come in for dinner. You will have gravy on the table. I said, okay, and headed back to the house. And I thought, now I know it has something to do with the grease that you fried the meat in, and I have two skillets of that and flour. I'm pretty sure it uses flour. I made gravy. Nine people came in for dinner. Nine people had my gravy on their mashed potatoes. Nine people cleared their plates. Not one person complained. But my brothers did tell me about 3 years later that finally I was making gravy they didn't have to cut with a knife and a fork.
Oh, Patricia, thank you so much for sharing your stories. You're a wonderful storyteller, and I'm sure that people at your session are going to learn a lot and enjoy it. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Rose Ballard Coffey is the former director of the Waverly Public Library. Her presentation is called Angels and Butterflies, Stories of My Mother and Father, Lifelong Iowans. She'll be presenting at History Camp on Saturday. And finally today, Madison Deshay Duncan is a graduate student at the School of Education at Iowa State University, president of Community Legacy Matters Incorporated, and a documentarian. Her presentation is a preview of her documentary. It's the Center Street Story, an urban renewal retrospective. Hello, Madison.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And for people who don't know about Center Street, tell me about this neighborhood.
Okay, Center Street was considered to be one of the most prolific African American communities in Des Moines during the 1950s and 1960s, but it goes back to about the 1920s. And so there was a really vibrant, thriving business district where people from all over the city would come to visit. It was considered to be the hub of the Black community in Des Moines. And it would have been located right now, the Oak Ridge, Homes of Oak Ridge are located there now and in between Methodist Hospital. So it's in between Keough and in that area, in between about 10th to 14th Street.
So it was a thriving, vibrant business district. Tell me a little bit about what kinds of businesses would have been there.
So you would have had, of course, you would have had your supper clubs. You would have had the Sepia Club, which was more of an upscale club where you'd have live bands come and play. And you had your dry cleaners and pretty much things that every other community had. You had churches and social clubs such as the Elks, and so it pretty much looked like any other community.
And it was, as I already said, the word thriving, but it attracted big name performers from all over the country, right?
Right. And so, yeah, Center Street would have hosted a lot of performers throughout the country, mainly because they weren't allowed to stay in downtown Des Moines at that time. And so that's kind of a real rich history there.
Absolutely.
And so they stay at the boarding houses. There was Mary Moore's boarding house that comes up a lot that some of the entertainers would have stayed at.
Now, you mentioned that it really was at its peak in the 1950s and 60s, and then there came an abrupt end to this rich and vibrant community in the 1960s. What happened?
Exactly. And so that's why it's called the Center Street Story, which talks a lot about the community, the first part of the documentary. And so you hear the voices of the people that lived in the community and grew up in the community. And then we get to the second part of that documentary, which is an urban renewal retrospective. And so in about 1949, we had the Federal Housing Act, which allowed for pretty much the demolition of and rebuilding of communities. And so you had this thought process of city beautiful. And so there was this move throughout the country to rehabilitate and communities, basically. And so, but the problem with that was that this targeted Black communities. And at the same time, I guess I should mention that you also had the freeway come through. So you had these two disruptions of the Black community. You had urban renewal, and then you had the freeway. And so for the Center Street community, it was in part the freeway, but the devastation and the demise of the community occurred because of the Oak Ridge Urban Renewal Project that was approved in 1957. And although it was approved then, it wasn't actually implemented until about 10 years later. And so that community pretty much disappeared by about 1973.
So there was eminent domain? Were properties taken? And
correct. So once the Oak Ridge Urban Renewal Project was approved, it was actually started out to be a rehabilitation project. There were rumors that they were going to come and take the properties from the business owners and the houses that were there. Because we're not just talking about businesses that, you know, the business district. We're talking about a community. And so those people stopped investing in their property. And so basically what happens is the property loses value over time, because we're talking about a 10-year period between the time the project was approved and the time that the properties were actually taken. And so what happens is you have, as you said, eminent domain, and people are offered certain amounts for their property, which oftentimes was not a fair amount, to relocate. And so that's kind of how that process occurred.
So
they really didn't have any choice.
Right. And what had been a vibrant, thriving community was basically treated as if it was open space.
Correct. There's one report that I like to talk about, Mr. DePatton, and he's since passed. But he was in the process of adding a second story to one of his properties. And he was a man that built his properties from the ground up. And it took quite a number of years for him to do that. And so he was in the process of the second story, building apartments. And when they came through to take the building and took the property, there was actually said that there was an announcement that there were free bricks that people could come in and pick up throughout the city. And they did that. And so one of the planners that I interviewed recalled that people used the bricks to landscape their gardens and things of that nature. And so here you have one man's devastation that becomes another man's garden, so to speak. And
this story has largely been, I guess, paved over, untold mm-hmm. over the years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are similar stories that happened in major cities all around the country that have gotten more attention. I think of Detroit, you know, immediately mm-hmm. off the top of my head. But why do you think it's so important to talk about what happened in Des Moines?
Thank you for asking that question, because that is really was the purpose of my research, is that the culturally significant communities throughout Iowa are sorely underrepresented in the national narratives on urban renewal. And so, but we are no less significant here in Iowa. And so that's what we use Center Street as a model of what happened throughout the country, and hopefully will represent all of those smaller communities that don't get mentioned, but were just as significant and culturally significant.
What do you hope people who come to your session at History Camp take away from the experience?
Well, we're going to show a preview of the documentary, and so I hope that it informs them about the community that was there, because a lot of people don't understand that there was a thriving Black community in Des Moines, especially when you compare it to what has happened today. And I hope that what they also take is that this type of disruption and disinvestment in Black communities throughout Iowa, it continues. This is not something that has ended over time. And so I'm hoping that we kind of start having conversations about, you know, using this history to inform us moving forward in terms of how we develop communities, including the Black community, and the significance of that.
And this is a preview of the documentary. When is that going to be available?
Okay, we're in the process of editing that, and we will have, hopefully we'll come back again when we talk about having a release date for that. But right now we're in the process of completing the final editing on that. So we're looking at a few months out.
All right, well, a busy time, and good luck to you. Thank you for talking with me, and do keep in touch. Let us know what's going on.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Madison Deshay Duncan is a graduate student in the School of Education at Iowa State University. She's president of Community Legacy Matters Incorporated. She's also been working on the documentary, The Center Street Story, an Urban Renewal Retrospective. She'll give a preview of that documentary at History Camp on Saturday, historycampiowa.org or historycamp.org/Iowa. You can still register for the event. I also want to mention another historical event coming up Thursday night in Iowa City. Iowa Watch and Iowa Public Radio present Roll Call. Veterans share their true stories. This is a live storytelling event at 7 p.m. at the Old Brick Church in Iowa City. You can find out more on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.